Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things that are going on over there. While you're over there, you can go to the events page because events are coming to you this 2020 in February and in March. February 22nd, we will be in Houston, Texas. Chad will be there. I'll be there. Matt Popovich, Scott Keith, Gretchen Ronovic, and Loso talking about what happens when people encounter Jesus. Come on out. It's free. You can register right there. Just go to the events page on the 1517 website. Get signed up. We would love to hang out with you. Also, if you're in the Las Vegas area, you know, or the deep Southern California area, you can drive on over and join us in Las Vegas. We're going to be talking about the entire book of Galatians, March 21st. Get all the information over there. I got links in the show notes. So if you're wanting just a quick click to get over there, just go to the show notes, click on those things. You know what I realized the other day, Chad, is that I told my daughter, it was the day after Christmas, and I said, "Oh man, are you excited? Only 364 more days until Christmas." And she said, "No, 365. I said, "No, no, no, it's 364. Like, yesterday doesn't count." She's like, "No, it's 365. And I said,
"We have an extra day coming up."
I know. And I said, "I don't think so." She's like, "Yeah, it's leap year." And I was like, "Oh, this whole thing backfired on me. My 11-year-old has shown me up."
Yeah. All those kids born on February 29th finally get to celebrate their birthday. Like, every 4 years,
yeah,
their birthday.
She said, "There's a boy in her class." She's like, "There's a boy in my class. It's three."
Yeah, forever young. It's like the opposite of dog years.
Yeah, I wonder if you're like born on the 29th of February. Every time that actually rolls around, they must make it. You have to nail it, right?
Oh man, yeah, it's gonna be a huge celebration.
Yeah, so
that's great.
So yeah, leap year that coming up this year, guys, going to be a good one. I hope. Chad, we're recording this on the very last day of 2019. It won't come out today, so this will come out in 2020. But we're going to see what happens, man. We have two chapters left. We're not making any promises, but we're going to see how far we get.
Hey, it might happen. Last day of 2019 could be the last recording for us and Joshua.
Seemed appropriate.
Yeah.
We could start into a new decade, man.
Yeah, we could leap into the crazy world of Judges. So we'll see what happens. But let's get rolling. We're in chapter 23, and it's relatively short, 16 verses, and then 24 is longer, but it's basically all the same kind of material. This is Joshua speaking to Israel, and it's sort of his last sermon, last address, at least, to the people of Israel. So we're coming off the heels of chapter 22, which, if you remember, was all about the dispute over this altar that the 2.5 tribes had built at the Jordan as a way of witnessing to their descendants and to the descendants on the west side of the Jordan that they were all Israel. So that was, as you remember, that was a kind of almost a violent episode, but it ended peacefully with an understanding between the tribes. So we're going to jump ahead now. In fact, we're going to jump ahead about 20 years. So there's a lot of time between chapter 22 and chapter 23. And we don't know exactly what happened during this time. Presumably, there was a little bit more conquering, not a complete conquering, but a little more conquering of some of the lands. And no doubt there was settling of the cities and all that kind of stuff that would have happened when Israel was making this land their own. But now we are near the end of Joshua's life. We know from the very end of the book that he dies at 110 years old. And we know that at this point, he's probably pretty near death. So it's probably safe to say he's 109, or maybe he's early into his 110th year, or whatever it is, he's at his life's end. So we're going to see what he has to say. This is kind of like Moses' farewell address in the book of Deuteronomy. You're going to hear some of the similar language that Joshua addresses to Israel. So we start out this way. Verse 1 says that it came about after many days when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side, and Joshua was old, advanced in years, that he called for all Israel. And then we have a list of the various groups that he called for, the elders and the heads and the judges and the officers. And then he starts his address, begins here with verse 2 and continues through verse 16. And when you read through these verses, if I summarized them, I'd probably say it was Joshua's way of doing two things. First of all, he's reminding them, as he has before, but he's reminding them in some unmistakably clear language that everything God promised, he has fulfilled. We're going to see that especially in verse 14, that every single promise that God gave them, he was faithful in fulfilling. So that's one of the themes of this chapter, is basically that God did what God promised to do. He brought them there. He fought for them. He gave them the land. Everything that he said he was going to do, he accomplished. And he did it for them. That's another one of the themes that comes up. This is not like for God. This is all for Israel. So you have a definite grace theme that permeates the chapter. But alongside that, what we might say alongside the gospel is also the law. There's also a very stern warning, and he picks up on the language both of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, warning them not to forsake the Lord's word, not to intermingle with the nations which are around them, not to intermarry with the various tribes of the Canaanites, because if they do, then all of the covenant curses which were pronounced back in Leviticus are going to befall them. So that's a theme that we see played out in these next few verses. So let me kind of give you an idea as to how some of it sounds. So he starts out here with verse 3 saying, "You have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you, for the Lord your God is he who has been fighting for you." So here with that warrior motif that we can trace all the way back to the Red Sea and the Song of Moses, where the Lord is actually called a warrior. So he's the one fighting for them. Verse 4 talks about how he's given them the inheritance of the land. He says, "See, I have apportioned to you these nations which remain as inheritance for your tribes, with all the nations which I have cut off, from the Jordan even to the great sea toward the setting of the sun. And the Lord your God, he shall thrust them out from before you and drive them out from before you, and you shall possess their land just as the Lord your God promised you." So we have an acknowledgement that, hey, part of the land remains unconquered, but God is going to keep fighting for you on your behalf to make sure that you're able to obtain all the land. And then he shifts gears in verse 6 to an encouragement, an admonition to the people to stick with what God has told them. Be very firm then. The Hebrew has something like, literally something like be strong to do, be strong to keep. So be firm to keep and to do all that's written in the book of the law of Moses, or more literally in the scroll of the teachings of Moses. So everything that Moses has given you, everything he's taught you, preached to you, cling to that. Don't turn aside to the right or to the left. And then he goes into, in verse 7, he goes into a warning about all the things that they shouldn't do. And it almost every single aspect of this has to do with idolatry. So he says that you may not associate with these nations, or intermingle is probably a better translation of that, these which remain among you. You shall not mention the name of their gods, or make anyone swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. Now, the word in my translation, mention, is probably not the best way to translate this. Because I remember reading this before I knew Hebrew. I was like, man, you can't even like say the name of these gods.
Say Voldemort.
Yeah. But the problem with that is like, it's a seeming contradiction. It's like, okay, you're not supposed to even mention the name of these gods, but the names of these gods are mentioned in lots of parts of the Old Testament. So, I mean, what gives here, right? So we have all the Canaanite gods. We have Babylonian gods later on. All these gods are mentioned by name in the Old Testament, and yet we're told here we're not supposed to mention their names, but it's a translation issue is what it is. So I think a better translation would be something like, you shall not invoke the name of their gods or profess the name of their gods. It's we've talked a lot about the verb for remember, zakar, and this is a causative form of this particular verb. So it's like, you shall not cause to be remembered the name of their gods, which is usually translated as something like, you shall not invoke them, you shall not profess them. So it's not just like saying the names. It's not like mentioning the names. It's actually a worship kind of term. In fact, that particular verbal form is often used for praise or adoration when it's talked about in the Psalms. So this is not just like mentioning in casual conversation the names of other gods. This is invoking those names in worship.
If you're not allowed to even mention it, it would imply that there's a lot of power in this name, right? I mean, if you're not even allowed to mention it, then it seems like you're sort of legitimizing this god. That don't even say it, dude. Don't even say the name of the, I mean, this is not at all how God speaks of other gods, or how Israel or the prophets or anyone else speaks of other gods. I mean, they speak of them as non-gods.
Yeah. So it's not the Voldemort, like you said earlier.
Yeah, it's not like when Elijah goes and confronts the prophets of Baal, he's like, "Oh, I'm so afraid to even say your god's name."
Yeah, quite the opposite. You know, the prophets mock the other gods. Yeah, Elijah mocked them. Isaiah goes to great lengths to mock the idols of the nations, or the idols that the Israelites are worshiping. You know, he talks about how, you take a piece of wood and you chop it in half, and one half you carve into an idol and you bow down to it. And the other half of the wood you chop up and you make a fire out of it and you cook your meal. Yeah. So it's his way of poking fun at idolatry. So in other words, don't take this to mean that you can't even say the names of these foreign gods as if there's something magical or powerful about them. No, it just, he's basically using a series of synonyms saying, don't do anything that is related to worship in connection with these strange gods.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even do that with the devil.
Right. Yeah, we're not afraid to say Satan or the devil or anything like that. Yeah, because there's no power. There's no power in that name. But instead of doing that, verse 8, and now we have the introduction of marriage language. You are to cling to the Lord your God as you have done to this day. So that verb there in Hebrew is davak. It's the same one that occurs in Genesis 2:24 when a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife. So this picks up the very common theme that we've already seen, and that is developed even more throughout the rest of the Old Testament, of God's marriage to Israel. So don't go adulterating yourself to these other gods by invoking their name or swearing by them or bowing down to them. Instead, remember that the Lord your God has married you to himself. He has become your divine husband. So cling to him, cleave to him, just like a wife does to her husband and a husband does to his wife. And then he goes on from there to describe how God has driven out these nations, and he's fulfilled the promise that he gave back in Leviticus 26, where he said that Israel would be so strong that one Israelite would put 1,000 of their enemies to flight. That's the kind of language he uses in verse 10. Because, of course, God is on their side. And then he goes on in the following verses to kind of repeat the same promises and warnings. So if you go back from God and cling to the other nations and intermarry with them and associate with them, then the opposite's going to happen. Instead of God driving them out, then he won't. Instead, verse 13 says that these nations will, and I love this imagery that he uses here, there shall be a snare and a trap to you, and a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes. So Joshua is like, you don't hear this kind of metaphorical language often in the book of Joshua, but Joshua is pulling from various images, like that word for snare can mean like a net that you get a bird with, snare birds with, or net birds with, or a trap, and you have whips on your sides and thorns in your eyes. So all that's going to happen if instead of clinging to God, you go whoring after other gods and cleave to them instead.
Yeah, it all makes sense until you get the thorn to your eye. I mean, it's snare and a trap. Yep. A whip on your side. Yep. I'm going to be driven by this thing. You have a thorn in your eyeball. And you're like, wait, what? What?
Whoa. He's pushed it there. Yeah. Probably the idea is that, I mean, you're basically, you're going to be blinded, right?
Yeah.
You're going to be snared. You're going to be caught in this trap. It's going to be a whip in your side and you'll be blinded. So don't do that. And then we have verse 14. Verse 14 is one of my favorite verses in Joshua because it, in many ways, is kind of a theme verse, or maybe even the theme verse of the whole thing. Here's what he says. Now behold, today I'm going the way of all the earth. And you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All have been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. So it begins by pointing out probably what is obvious, that he's old, his end is near, and he's going the way of all the earth, which is the same kind of language that David uses later. In fact, exact same language that David uses later when he's about to die and he's encouraging Solomon, his son. So Joshua is encouraging the Israelites. So he's going the way of all the earth. In other words, he's about to end this life. And then he repeats over and over the Hebrew word for the root for word, which is devar. So you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one devar, not one word, of all the good devarim, of all the words which the Lord your God worded to you, spoke to you, has failed. So we have this repeated emphasis upon what God, the word that God gave is the word that God kept. So he's the God who is always faithful to his promises. So not one word of all those good words which the Lord spoke has failed. We saw this, I can't remember which chapter it was, but we saw this language before. Literally in the Hebrew, it's not one word has dropped, not one word has fallen. We saw that, I think, one or two chapters back. So everything, the image is like God is holding all these words in his hand, all these promises, and none of them fell out. None of them fell to the ground. Instead, they were all fulfilled by him. They all came true. Yeah, well, and that is kind of the ultimate theme of Joshua.
One of the things I like about this too is all the good things and all the good words. Which is interesting. You're like, well, you know, you're just saying that God is good. Well, God said a lot of things that weren't so good. And a lot of those things didn't come to pass, even though they certainly could have. God does a lot of do this or else this is going to happen to you. And not all that stuff happens because all that stuff is ultimately going to happen to Christ, right? And so he does all the good things that he promises to do, but doesn't always do the bad things that he says he's going to do.
Yeah. That's a great thing to keep in mind when you read through sections like Leviticus 26, where you have the curses and the blessings. You know, a lot of, we talked about those curses and just how horrendous they were. Now, one thing to keep in mind is if you look through the rest of the history of the Old Testament, a lot of bad things happened to Israel. I mean, a lot of bad things happened to Israel because they did forsake the Lord their God. But at no point did all of those curses ever completely befall Israel.
No.
I mean, there were a lot of bad things that happened. They went into exile. You know, their cities were demolished. A lot of people died. But there were a lot of things that were threatened against Israel, like complete decimation, that never happened. So God was saving all of that until finally the true Israelite, the one who was Israel reduced to one, would come, and then actually all of those curses did befall him. So all of that bad stuff we were talking about actually did fall on the head of the Messiah.
Yep.
Okay. The chapter finishes out basically with a repetition of what he's been saying earlier, that God is going to remain faithful and don't transgress his covenant or else. That's the way the chapter ends with verse 16. So with that, let's just go ahead and unless there's something else you want to add, we'll just jump right into to 24, because we have another Joshua address, different than this one, different location probably, but this is Joshua speaking some more. We ready? Go on. All right. So chapter 24 begins this way. So chapter 23 began by Joshua gathering, calling for all Israel, and chapter 24 begins the same way, except here, we don't know exactly where 23 took place because it doesn't tell us, but chapter 24 does. It tells us that Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and he called for the same groups that we saw referenced in the previous chapter, the elders and the heads and the judges and the officers, and they presented themselves before God. So a little bit different scenario here. So here, we know where they're at. They're at Shechem. I'll talk about that in just a second. And we know that they are presented themselves before God. So previously, we know the tabernacle was set up at Shiloh. But evidently what happened is they took the tabernacle apart and they transported it here to Shechem and set it up. Because we know from later in the chapter that the tabernacle actually is here. And when it says that people presented themselves before God, usually that's an Old Testament idiom for they gathered there at the tabernacle, because of course it was God's house, it was his tent. So they're before God and they're at Shechem. And this is another case where geography is theology, which is one of the major components of the way that the Old Testament presents theology. It presents theology geographically. So cities matter, rivers matter, seas matter, wildernesses matter, mountains matter. So you can't separate the theology of the Old Testament or the New Testament as far as that goes, but certainly you can't separate that from the geography. They're both theology and geography go together. So what is significant about this particular place? Why would they gather at Shechem? Because Shechem goes all the way back to the days of Abraham. So when God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees, and he arrived in the land of Canaan, the very first place that he went to back in Genesis chapter 12 was Shechem. That's the first place he stopped at. That's the first place that he built an altar at. So Shechem has roots all the way back to the days of Abraham. Not only that, but that's also the area where later on Jacob bought a patch of ground. So we know that Jacob owned land there at Shechem. And I think what's most fascinating is that, I think it's Genesis 35, Jacob says to his family and to everyone who was kind of part of his household to get rid of all of their foreign gods, and they buried those gods under an oak tree there at Shechem. Now, the reason that's so rich is because later in this chapter, in Joshua 24, they place a stone of remembrance right there by an oak at Shechem. And I can't help but think it's the same place. You got Shechem, you have an oak tree, and there were foreign gods that were buried there all the way back in the time of Jacob. And now here we are generations later, and they're setting up a stone of remembrance there at that same oak that is by Shechem. So it's sort of like history has come full circle. Israelite history has come full circle. Abraham arrived here first, and now here is Israel in the days of Joshua. They have now taken the land that God promised to Abraham. And now you have Joshua addressing Israel, saying basically, hey, put away your foreign gods, just like Jacob told them, and serve the Lord your God and serve him only. So we have this tie-in between Genesis and the last chapter of Joshua. So the site is significant. The fact that this took place at Shechem has implications that go all the way back to the days of Abraham.
It's almost like God never stops saying, put down your idolatry.
Yeah, over and over.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like always the issue, isn't it?
It's like the number one thing he says. It's like, all right, enough with these gods.
Yeah, I mean, we really don't even need 10 commandments. One is all we need, right?
Well, if you boil it down, some people, you know, have questions about God, and I mean, you can paint God in sort of a very demanding light. But at the end of the day, really all God is after for himself is just to be God.
Mm-hmm.
All he really wants for himself, I mean, everything else is for you. The only thing he really wants for himself is like, can I be me?
Yeah.
With all these other false gods running around. It'd be like if there's like a, you know, a million people out there claiming to be me. And all I wanted was like, hey, I mean, can we just acknowledge that I'm me?
Yeah. You know how angry we get when we have identity theft take place?
Yeah.
You know, somebody takes your credit card. It's happened to me. It's probably happened to you. It's happened to almost everybody I know at some point. Somebody has claimed my identity to make a purchase. And I was pissed off. I'm like, what the hell? You know? Yeah. Somebody's claiming, you know, using my credit card, claim to be me and doing this. And yet when you stop to think about it, yeah, God is just saying, hey, don't like be identifying me with a lot of falsities and lies. Don't be doing some kind of identity theft as far as I'm concerned. Just, yeah, like you say, just let me be God. Let me be who I am.
Be like if my kid was like hanging out at this other person's house that was claiming to be me and she was like giving him her Christmas list and like all this stuff. And I'm like, what in the world?
Yeah.
Can I just be your dad? What in the heck?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, and it's to use the marriage analogy. I mean, it'd be like God is the husband saying, would you mind just sleeping with me, you know, yeah, being my wife instead of always carousing with all these other lovers? That's what he wants from Israel. Just love me. I mean, that's really the command, right? Love me with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength. I'm your faithful divine husband. So don't, and I'll give you everything that you need. So don't go looking to other gods or other goddesses for everything that I am fully and graciously prepared to give you.
Yeah, this is why the family language is the language that's always used, right? I mean, you have the children of Israel and you have, of course, you know, the children of God, right? Most people can relate to that. If you have kids, like, well, that'd be horrible. If your kids left you for somebody else to take care of them, you know, that would be fairly hurtful. Mm-hmm. And then you have the spousal language, of course. I mean, the adultery language and stuff all throughout the Bible as well. So both of these things are completely understandable if you're either a spouse to someone or if you have children. You're like, yeah, that's a pretty massive betrayal. And so at the end of the day, God is just saying, can I just be the thing that I am to you?
Mm-hmm.
Which if you paint it like that, which is the correct way to paint it, it's a completely reasonable request.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, we sometimes complicate the matters, but to simplify it, that's exactly what God wants to do. So let me be me. And when you do that, and when you love me, then you will actually be you. You will be who I created you to be. But that's, of course, the ongoing temptation for the Israelites, as well as for us today, is to turn to other gods. And that's why we constantly have a call from God to put away the idols. So anyway, that's the way it starts, actually, when he gathers people at Shechem and he assembles them before God. Joshua starts out by reminding the people that their origins, that Abraham's origins, were in idolatry. Joshua said to the people of Israel that from ancient times, your fathers lived beyond the river, that's the Euphrates, lived beyond the Euphrates River, namely Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. This is important to point out that before God called Abraham, he was enmeshed in idolatry. It's important to point out because there you'll sometimes see, and this especially from Judaism. Judaism is big on legends, which attribute monotheism and fidelity to Abraham prior to God calling him. So there's all sorts of kind of crazy legends about Abraham opposing the idolatry of his father. I remember one story where Abraham's father kept all his idols in this little, you know, building sanctuary or something like that. And young Abraham was so zealous for Yahweh that he set fire to this idolatrous building and burned it to the ground. Well, all of that is nothing more than just legend. It's just stories that people made up. What we're told from the scriptures is that Abraham was raised in an idolatrous household. His dad was an idolater, and no doubt Abraham was too. So there wasn't, it wasn't like God went looking for that one faithful person that he could call and make to be the patriarch of a new nation. No. As it goes on to say in verse 3, then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river. So this is completely God's initiative. So he called Abraham out of idolatry to be the patriarch of Israel. He didn't find Abraham faithful, and as a result of that call him, he called him and he made Abraham faithful. So it's an important distinction to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's that theology of glory hermeneutic that comes flying in when we read the Old Testament. We want to read some stuff in there, Abraham, or there was a book just called Noah. It's a kid's book. It's about Noah, and it starts with everyone was terrible and bad and so evil, and God was very sad and decided he had to get rid of all the people. But then there was Noah, and Noah, and Noah was the one good man.
I've read those,
and you're like, what? Where does it say that?
When my kids were little, and I'd read them children's Bible stories, or when my grandsons now, when I read them stories, I'm constantly editing on the fly. I like never just read the story out of the book because it's almost always wrong. So I just edit as I'm reading it.
Well, when I don't know why we're talking about this, but other than this Abraham thing, but yeah, what I always do is I read that and I'm like, okay, it says that everybody was evil and that all the thoughts of their heart were like continuously wicked all the time. Seems very all inclusive.
Very universal. Yeah.
And then it says, but Noah found favor in the eyes of God. And I'm like, that sounds like a dude that straight tripped into some grace. Like he just found it. He just stumbles upon it. Like, does it say he like earned it or he was good or anything? Just like, there he was being an evil wretch and just stumbled right into some mercy.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, that's exactly what happened. Yeah. So watch those children Bible stories.
and Abraham's the same way. I mean, we would love to think of Abraham came out the womb and was zealous for the pure, unadulterated worship of God, but this is not the case.
Didn't happen that way. No, God took him, it says in verse 3, took him from that. And in the rest of the verses, all the way through 13, so about 2 through 13, is Joshua summarizing the history from Genesis 11 all the way to the present day. So he reaches back, I don't know, 700 years or whatever it is, from the days of Abraham, and he tells a story, more or less. He says, God took Abraham, and then he gave Abraham Isaac, who had Jacob and Esau, and then he goes on to talk about Moses and Aaron, and he recounts everything that God did for them. So this is Joshua's way of kind of setting the stage. So he's telling his Israelites, hey, look all the way back to the beginning of Abraham's life and just trace exactly what God did for your forefathers as well as for you. He brought Abraham out from idolatry. He gave him Isaac. And from Isaac came these descendants. And then these descendants ended up in Egypt. And God brought us out and he gave us this land. So he's setting this all up, Joshua is, by recounting this salvation history. So then he ends it by saying in verse 13 that he's brought them here and he's given them a land that they didn't work for. He gave them cities they didn't build. And he gave them vineyards and olive groves that they didn't plant. So everything that God has done for them is pure gift. And what does God say in response to this? Verse 14. So fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth and put away the gods which your father served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. So this is where we have once more, all this has happened, and yet we still know that the Israelites, at least some of them, are holding on to their idols. And then we, after that, we have this famous section. So this is verse 15. If it is disagreeable in your sight, literally if it's evil in your sight, if it's disagreeable or evil in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve. Now, this is probably the most famous verse in Joshua. Listen carefully. You probably got this on a plaque on your wall.
Well, you got the second half of it.
Second half.
You never have. If it is evil in your sight to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve.
And what people don't notice, this is extremely significant. So he gives them two choices. Listen, he says, choose for yourself today whom you'll serve. And here are the two choices. The gods whom your father served, who were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. Those are your two choices. So if you're going to make a choice, okay, if you don't want to serve God, here are your two choices. You can choose. You can choose on the other side of the Jordan, or you can choose on this side of the Jordan. Idols way over there. If it's like evil, disagreeable to you to serve God, well, here's a couple choices. You can serve the gods that are way over there, or you can serve the gods who are over here. So that's the, as far as choice goes, the choice is all about idolatry.
Yeah.
But then Joshua follows that up by saying, but as for me, my house, we will serve the Lord. He did say it was his choice to serve the Lord. That I think is what's most significant here. He didn't go on to say, but as for me and my house, we have chosen to serve the Lord.
Well, this is the thing. This is what I'm talking about. Like, this middle section is always cut out. So always you hear this verse quoted, choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And you're like, this is not what it says. Not what it says. It can be boiled down to this. When you choose who you will serve, your only options are idols.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's it. Like, you will always choose idols.
Put that on your plaque.
Yes.
Yeah. We probably insulted lots of people right now. Sorry. But yeah, I mean, it's important. You can't like leave out parts of the verse and expect to really get what it's saying. So this isn't Joshua saying, choose Yahweh. He's saying, if you're going to choose, well, your only options are idols.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is like, look, man, if you're not going to get rid of your idols, like, then go all in.
Yeah, none of this half Yahweh, half Baal business. Yeah. Quit limping between the two alternatives, like Elijah says. Yeah, I mean, if you don't want to serve God, okay, well, you got lots of idols to choose from.
Yep.
You know, but don't go jumping from bed to bed.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He doesn't say, but we choose Yahweh. He just makes a declarative statement that this is what is.
Yeah, this is what is. All right, so the people respond in 16 and following. Oh, no. Listen, far be it from us to serve anybody but the Lord. I mean, he's done all this for us. Far be it from us to serve anybody but the Lord our God.
Yeah, very, very far be it from them.
Yeah.
Far be it from any of us.
After being just told that they're supposed to put away their idols. And then Joshua... And what I think is one of the more humorous verses says to the people, they've just, you know, claimed full allegiance to God. And Joshua says, nope, you will not be able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He's a jealous God, and he will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. This is Joshua saying, nope, not going to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to serve the Lord your God because he's holy and he's jealous. And I've just told you to put away your idols. So this is like a very in your face moment.
No, this is great. I mean, like, far be it from us. No, man, we're all in on Yahweh. No, you're not. No, you're not going to be able to do that. Yeah. That's not one of the options I gave you.
Yeah. So he goes on, if you forsake him, and then he will turn and do the harm to you and consume you after he's done good to you. So if you don't serve him, here's what's going to happen. And the people go on to, you know, claim, no, we're going to serve God. So Joshua says, all right, well, you have witnessed against yourself that this is what you're going to do. Calls them to put away their foreign gods, and he makes a covenant with them that day. And they set up this stone in verse 26, and put it under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. So this stone is going to serve as a reminder to Israel that they will serve the Lord their God and serve him only. So that's the end of that section. The book ends, and we will end the podcast with this, that that Joshua died at the age of 110. He didn't quite make it to the age of Moses, but close, 110 years old. They buried him. And it says all Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua. And it says they also, we have to pick up the story from way back, that they buried the bones of Joseph. Remember, they carried the bones of Joseph with them when they left Egypt. And they finally buried those at Shechem, same place where we've been, in the piece of ground which Jacob had bought. So the bones of Joseph were finally laid to rest. And the book ends with Eleazar, the son of Aaron, so the one who had replaced his father as high priest. He dies, and he's buried at Gibeah of Phinehas, his son, in the hill country of Ephraim. So this is all the setup for what is coming next in the book of Judges, where we're going to hear what happens after the death of Joshua.
It is a kind of a big deal with the death of Joshua, because there won't be another figure like Joshua until, you know, Israel demands a king. I mean, there won't be this sort of unanimous leader that you know, all the tribes are around and like, this is God's man. Mm-hmm. Not in the same way. And really not until David. I mean, you'll have Saul, but really until David.
The closest we get before King Saul is Samuel.
Yeah.
But he's, of course, he's not a Joshua, but as far as like being somewhat of a centralizing leader. Yeah. And even Saul, he's mainly just followed by his own tribe, by the Benjaminites. So it's not until David where we have a true union of all the tribes under one definitive strong leader. So we have a long time gap between this particular leader's death and the rising of a new leader.
Yeah. Yeah. So it really is sort of a closing of an era. Obviously there is a difference also between someone like Joshua and David in the sense that, well, David's a king. So,
right. And I guess we'll get there eventually.
We will.
We got to get through Judges first.
We do. We're going to get through the freak show that is Judges, and that's going to be exciting, guys. So we will see you next week, Chad.
All right. See you then.